And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive. Can I take these off? All right. What is this? This looks good. Wow. That's well made. Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company, affiliates, and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Welcome to Creating a Family. Talk about adoption and infertility. Today we're going to be talking about foster care adoption, transitioning from foster to adopt. I'm Dawn Davenport. I'm the director of Creating a Family. We are the National Adoption and Infertility Education and Support Nonprofit, and you can find us online at creatingafamily.org. Did you know that we have an online multimedia guide for helping you find the perfect adoption agency or adoption attorney for you? The title of it is Choosing an Adoption Agency or Adoption Attorney, and you can find it on our site. The easiest way is to go to our resources on the horizontal menu, hover over it, and then click on e-guides. And that e-guide is available. It is chock full of really helpful and interesting information if you are in the process of having to choose an agency, including a foster care agency. It is truly the go-to resource. We primarily keep in touch with our audience through our weekly e-newsletter. We would love to have you on it. You can sign up for our adoption newsletter once a week at the top right-hand side of any page of our website. This radio show is brought to you by our corporate sponsor, Ferring Pharmaceutical. Fighting cancer does not have to mean a loss of your fertility. If you or a loved one are facing cancer, you may be eligible for no-cost medication through Ferring's Heartbeat Program. To learn more, go to their website, heartbeatprogram.com. This show, as well as all the resources provided by Creating a Family, could not happen without the generous support from our gold sponsors, who believe in our mission of providing unbiased education and support to those struggling to create a family. Some of our wonderful gold sponsors include Vista Del Mar. They are a licensed and accredited nonprofit adoption agency with over 65 years of experience helping to create families. They have three adoption programs, private infant, international, and foster care. We also have Adoption Connection. They are a California-based adoption agency working with families throughout the U.S. They were a national pioneer in open adoption and are respected for their ethical practices, compassion, and openness to adoptive and birth families of all types. We have Children's Connection. They are an adoption agency with offices throughout Texas, providing domestic infant adoption, embryo net donation adoption, home studies, and post-adoption support to families throughout the United States. And we also have other sponsors. Those are some of our gold sponsors. We have others, but we have other sponsors that are not gold sponsors, and you can they still believe in our mission, and it's through their generosity that they allow us to bring you this show. So when choosing an adoption service provider, please consider choosing one from the Creating a Family directories, which you can find on our Find the Professional page of our site. You can search by a number of factors, location, services provided, and others that will help you make the decision. And by using these directories, you support those who support us, and we thank you. As I said at the beginning, we are going to be talking today about foster care adoption, transitioning, and specifically transitioning that period of transition from foster care to an adoptive family. Our guest today to talk about this are Kim Fagan-Hansel. She is the editor of Fostering Families Today magazine, as well as the book, The Foster Parenting Toolbox. We also have Madeline Krebs. She is clinical coordinator at the Center for Adoption Support and Education, and she has over 35 years of experience working with families who are in all aspects of adoption, including those transitioning from foster care to an adoptive family. This was a show we aired quite a few years ago. The information is not only evergreen, it is priceless. It is so useful and so helpful. And we wanted to bring it to you again, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I have. Welcome, Kim and Madeline, to Creating a Family.
Thank you.
Good morning.
We adoption professionals think of the move from being in foster care to adoption as a good thing, but this is not always the way children see it. Madeline, what are some of the reasons a child may view this move with hesitation or even outright resistance?
Well, there may be many reasons, and many of it's depending on age and the history of the child in the foster care system. Many children have been in 2, 3, 4 homes plus. Some have been in previous pre-adopt placements that have not gone forward. And as we know, children who come from the foster care system have had either abuse or neglect. And so they come with a lot of fears and a lot of anxieties about, oh, yeah, here's another set of parents. I wonder if they'll keep me. And so they feel a loss of control. They didn't ask to come into care, most of them. They didn't have a whole lot of input into the foster care, foster parents that they were given. And so there are a lot of fears. There's a lot of anxiety, and there's a lot of worry. So they come with a backpack of history that pre-adopt parents have to be mindful of and learn as much as they can even before they visit the child or the child visits them, if at all possible.
You know, you made a statement about children many times having been in 2, 3, 4 plus or more foster homes. In the mid-1990s, there was federal legislation that was passed that was supposed to reduce this. I mean, that's been the rap against foster care for a long time, that kids get bounced around in the system. I guess my question is this, and this one I'll direct to Kim. Is that happening less now, or do we still see a lot of kids who are being bounced around to a fair number of homes before a permanency plan is made, or either kinship care or adoption or family reunification?
Unfortunately, you know, I think we're still seeing it way too much. It's happening more than it should be. And there's a lot of factors with that. The turnover rate of foster parents is very high because it's hard work that they're doing. You know, sometimes the kids may not fit well into the home. There's just a lot of factors into that. I think we're more aware now that these kids need to be put into a good family, a good home from day one that will hopefully be there for their term in foster care and possibly adopt them if that becomes a possibility.
Well, and I think another thing that we hear here at Creating a Family is that what sometimes, and actually not infrequently, happens is that children are in foster care, the parents, their biological parents get their act together, start working their program, kids go back, things fall apart, kids come back into care, or they're in care, an aunt steps forward, keeps them for a while, and then for whatever reason is not able to, and then the children come back into care. So we have a bit of that going between the biological family and the foster care system. Do you see, Kim, that is also happening?
Definitely. There's a move towards kinship care, trying to find those connections with biological families before they look at adoption and some other alternatives. Each case is different. Each child is different. Each family scenario is different. So it's really a case by case. But, you know, at least we have the legislation that is, mm-hmm. you know, needed to be followed. And we know more. We know what's good for these kids. And I think in many cases we're seeing, you know, positive following of that legislation.
This is Madeline.
Yeah, Madeline.
I think also there is great pressure for permanency. I mean, there's mm-hmm. federal legislation, there's the state and county commitments. At the same time, children are coming into care at an older age than they were 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Huh.
And so they're coming into care, I think, you know, 8 years plus of age is, I think there's some general statistic on that. They're certainly not coming in as babies and infants. And so you have, it's difficult to suddenly have a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old or a 14-year-old come in your home as a foster parent and everybody be on the same page in terms of how to best parent this child for however long. There's a lot of There's a lot of uncertainty that these children feel, and there's a lot of uncertainty for the foster parents as well. So I think we have to continue as a group to provide much more support and education for foster parents and for birth families, because they're doing the visitation. And I think the birth families, honestly, oftentimes get the least amount of support. So everybody in that, anybody touched by that child, needs a tremendous amount of support and education.
Madeline, do you see them getting that support?
I think it's
increasing. Anybody who touches the child, so to speak?
I think it's increasing. I think there is a recognition that this is a pretty complex culture we live in right now for parenting. Anybody, not just fostering and adoptive kids.
As a mother, I would agree with that.
So, I mean, there's a lot more pressures. So I think we're doing a better job. I think it depends on the agency. I think as long as there is a financial crunch, and it is across the board for the states and for the counties, we have to be vigilant to make sure that we have the funds to do the trainings, to do the support, to have the 24-hour hotline, to have parents come in and sit as a group and do sharing. There's a lot of work to do.
Well, yeah, and to also have the money, this is a whole other topic, but to have the money to keep the caseworker's load reasonable so that he or she can even attempt to do these things. If, you know, if you've got too many children assigned to your caseload, then there's no possible way that you're going to be able to make a good transition or be supportive to all the players involved. Sometimes, actually often, a child is being adopted by the foster family that he has been living with. One would assume that this transition would be easier. Madeline, is that true? Is it an easier transition at that point?
You're going to hear me say frequently, it depends.
That's okay, because it does depend.
It does depend. I think oftentimes it's much smoother than if they're going to somebody who's a stranger. I think what I see as a clinician is that some foster families think, okay, now that we've adopted, all those behaviors will go away because they were just uncertain. But what I educate adopting foster parents is that either shortly before the finalization or shortly after, the child is going to have some issues come up. And oftentimes it is testing, because a lot of these kids have been in a lot of different homes before they ended up in this, what's going to be their permanent home. And so they want to say, are you sure about this? Or are you sure on the front end or the back end? Once parents hear that, I've had many, many adoptive parents come back and say, well, you got that right. I don't know why he suddenly, you know, acted like he did, but I remember what you said. And so that's the kind of working closely to educate the fostering parents who are adopting, and then also to understand that the grief and loss really kicks in then. Children don't want to, and I don't think we do either, want to really open up our hearts to people if we're going to be moving. And so
well,
it
also,
is for kids.
It also isn't a permanent thing, that the separation from the biological family is not permanent until all of a sudden adoption is the option that is being seriously considered. So wouldn't that also explain that the grief and loss would be coming to the surface at that point, because now all of a sudden it is a real loss opposed to a potential loss.
Yeah, that's true. And for many children, they're in open adoptions. And so that's another thing, is that the visitation may take a different form with their birth families, the siblings, the birth mother and father. It may be with the adoptive parents rather than with the social worker. So there's a lot of changes post-finalization that impact the adoptive parents and impact the foster child.
Here's a question from Bellamy. She says, we are fostering a brother and sister ages 6 and 4. It looks like we will be able to adopt them since family reunification is not going well. I'd love some ideas on ways we can start to prepare the kids now and ways we can make this whole thing easier on them. Well, that is a loaded question in the sense that it's quite a broad one, but that's good because that's exactly what we want to talk about is some practical ways that people can foster people who are currently fostering or even not. But sticking with her question is current foster parents who anticipate that they will become adoptive parents. Kim, what are some ideas that if you are fostering to adopt, and it's a hard position in a way because at one point you may be hoping to adopt, but you also take on the obligation to try to work with the family reunification plans, or very often that is the case. How hard is that with the concurrent planning, that kind of the current approach that we are taking now in foster care?
It's very difficult, and I'll steal a line from one of our writers in the book, James Kenney, and he says, when you're in third grade, it's a long time till lunch. And, you know, that's the reality for these kids. They're living in limbo. They don't know who they're going to live with for sure. And, you know, it's a real challenge for them. What a gray area to be in and so emotional and things to deal with. Specifically to her question about preparing them for the transition, I'm going to flip to an article by Claudia Fletcher in the Foster Parenting Toolbox. And one of the things that she says is work on a timeline or a life book with children. Give them their story. Put it in pictures. Put it in words. You know, work on that together. Make it a project. It opens a whole wealth of opportunities to question and answer what their history is. And, you know, they'll always have that moving forward to look at.
This is Madeline. I would just like to add and validate the importance of pictures. I just had a family recently, and they have all their pictures on disc, and they hadn't printed them. And once the little boy had pictures of his birth mother, he took the pictures to bed and kept it on his pillow. So that I think we have to tell the story and have the pictures off the computer, please. And in their hands in a little booklet, and begin to talk about and be sure that you continue to talk about something positive about the birth family.
Well, you raised that point. Okay, so one of the practical tips that Kim just said was the creating a life book, which we've done. We have both resources on that. We've also done a number of shows on that. You can find those resources hover over the word adoption on the horizontal menu, click on resources, and we have a section on life books, which we'll link to the radio shows that we've done on that topic. Okay, so life book is one. Madeline, I'm going to guess that another one is, as regardless of how you feel about the birth parents, maintaining a positive attitude and not talking bad about them. Why is that important for helping children transition to adoption? I mean, you could see that the argument would be they're not going to be able to parent, the birth parents are not going to be able to parent, therefore what does it really matter?
Well, it matters a great deal. I don't know if the 4 and the 6-year-old, how long they've been in this home and do they have contact with the birth family, but let's say they do, then they know that that's their first mommy and she may have had troubles, but she still loves them. Or if she was TPR'd because of, you know, serious neglect and abuse, it still means that she can't parent, but she still loves them. And that's their DNA genetic connection. And when they get to the point of who am I like, when they start to deal with their identity, they have not one, but two DNA, not DNA, but two families that they have to begin to identify with. How am I like my adoptive parents, and how am I like my birth parents? My eyes, my hair, my talents. If they feel that only bad, they're bad, then they're going to think that they're bad because they're working on how am I like them. So it isn't being deceptive. It's not. It is being truthful. Mommy had a hard time taking care of you, keeping you safe. And so that's why you need a family who you can stay with and grow up with and be loved. And as the children get older, they will ask more complex questions. So you want to be truthful, but you also have to be honest and truthful and honest and age appropriately give them information that they may already have come with and know.
I think that especially if it's hard information that is why the child was removed from their first families, kids already, even at young age, have a sense of that.
Mm-hmm.
They lived it. One of the other things that, and we're referring to an article in the Foster Parenting Toolbook. This is the one edited by Kim, and it's a great, great resource. Now, it is geared more towards foster parents, but I cannot recommend it highly enough for any parent who is adopting from the foster care system, because much of the same information is incredibly useful. And it's uplifting, it's supportive, it's a great book. One of the things, Madeline, I heard you say right then, and it is somehow giving the children permission to be able to love more than one person. And I'm going to direct this question to Kim. How do we do that as parents? How do we, at the same time, we want them to know that we love them, but we want them to know that their first families, even if they weren't able to care for them, still love them. So how do we get that message across?
I think it's important that we start telling them right away. I think if adoptive parents can do their own work with themselves and get over the fact that, and deal with the grief and loss issues they personally have with the thought that, they did not give birth to this child, they missed out on, years 1, 2, and 3, if they can get themselves in a good spot, then they're going to be able to give their children what they need. And that is an understanding that there are many people in their lives who love them. And even in families that do not involve adoption, we have a wealth of people. We have aunts and uncles, grandparents, friends who love our children. And what's wrong with giving them one more?
Yeah, and if you have more than one animal in the house, you can say that you love the cat, you love the dog, you love both, you love your siblings, although not always equally, you love your mom and your dad. It's possible to love so many different people, and it's possible for different people to love you as well. Here is a question from Mimi. She says, we are adopting a sibling set from foster care. We have asked for up to 3, with the oldest no older than 10. I'd love suggestions on how to ease the transition. What can we as adoptive parents do to make it easier for these children to come into our home? It sounds like they don't have a specific set assigned to them yet, although I'm not clear on that. Madeline, what are some specific things that adoptive parents can do to prepare both their home and their attitude, as well as when they have an assignment of children, a match for children, the children themselves, for moving into their home as an adoptive placement?
Well, I think the first thing would be, and I don't know if this family has other children, my guess is maybe not, but they need to really bone up on normal child development. They need to really kind of digest before they come, because you never have that reading time again, that what's normal for 2, what's normal for 8, give or take some, so that they begin to build that up. They need to educate themselves about trauma. They need to understand the trauma triggers that happen in all of us. And they need to really look at what their expectations are. My experience clinically is that both the child and the parents have way too high expectations for themselves and for each other. It's going to take a long time. It's a building an attachment. It's building a relationship. And it's dealing with trust. So this is a tall order. This is not love at first sight. This is not love working perfectly smooth at first sight. And so they need to understand as much as they can about children and then foster care children. And then really take a look at themselves, as Kim has said. They really have to know what their triggers are, what sets them off, and be able to do some self-examination so that they, as a duo, if this is a two-parent house, that they work as a team, that they have good communication, and a good support system. If they're really going to take up to three kids, they need to have a lot of people who are going to not only be there to help them with the children, but also to provide them support and encouragement and maybe respite.
Mm-hmm. And it's helpful if those people also have a clue as to what some of the issues of trauma and abuse and neglect and grief and all those the issues you have mentioned. Yes, I would agree. If once they have children identified, Kim, what are some specific things that both the adoptive family, which is what Mimi is, as well as if we're going, if and the foster family, can do together to make this transition and caseworkers and all the others involved? What are some things, specific ideas that all these people, all these adults in the children's life can do to work together, as well as the birth family, can do to work together to make this transition as smooth as possible?
Typically, a case plan will allow for ongoing visitation, and it slowly builds. It's progressive. So you'll start with visiting for one day, and then it'll be overnight, and then it'll be a weekend, and that'll slowly transition the children to the home. I think for the adoptive parents, the prospective adoptive parents, something that I would consider very quickly is getting pictures of the children on your wall, making them feel like they are part of home, of your home and of your family, getting things in their rooms that they're comfortable with, that they're used to, so it doesn't feel like I'm just showing up in some stranger's house suddenly and now what do? I mean, we all, tonight I know where I'm going. I'm going home. What if someone met me at the door and said, I'm sorry, you don't live here anymore, I'm taking you somewhere else? How does that make you feel? Does that not, I mean, to me, I would immediately be fearful of what is unknown. So definitely slow transitions, making the children feel comfortable as they enter the home. And then definitely I want to back up everything Madeline said because, you know, that's so true. You know, just preparing yourself and getting ready for what these kids have been through and what issues you might have come up, getting a clinician in place to work with you, all of those things are very important.
How often, Kim, do you see now the discussions facilitated between the adoptive parents and the foster parents? I would hope that would be absolutely standard and that it would happen, you know, there'd be as much communication as you could possibly have between these two sets of parents. Do you see that happening now?
You know, I've been doing the work with the magazine for 10 years, and I would say, yes, we're getting better, but I think a lot of times some of these prospective adoptive parents come with the thought that I just want a child, and they haven't given a lot of thought to what the child's needs are going to be today and tomorrow and the next day and how important those people are who are in their life right now and how important they are to connecting the pieces of their story. You can have somebody who's adopted as an infant, and they still feel like there's something missing in a lot of cases. So we need to give them the pieces of their story and, you know, not just say their day started the day they were adopted.
This is Madeline. I agree, Kim, and I think one of the challenges for agencies now, we are moving children around the country. So I'm on the East Coast, and I've had kids in therapy who have been from the West Coast. Parents, pre-adopts, go out to Oregon and California, and they visit a couple times, and then they bring them here. Huge cultural changes for these children. So that it, I think if they're in the community, moving from one town to another, there's more opportunity to maintain some connection with the fostering family. Particularly when the child wants that, that helps them not feel like they've been, as Kim said, sort of dropped into an entirely, you know, stranger's house, which they will be, but over time there can be more visitation. more connection. They don't have to necessarily lose that fostering parent. They can achieve special relationship status. I think for older kids, they want to shape what their bedroom is going to look like, that you do minimal and then ask them what would they like for their room, if it's reasonable, so that they participate in creating their own space is really important. And getting as much information from the fostering family, food preferences, bedtime routines, who likes touch, who doesn't. I think we're doing better, but there's much, much more work to do on this sort of thing.
Yeah, I think we could probably say that about a lot of stuff with having to do with foster care. Let me talk some about the issue of openness in open adoption when you adopt from the foster care. And what I want to talk about is, number one, is it beneficial to children? And two, who do we maintain openness with? Because there are so many potential options. Obviously, we think of openness in infant adoption. We are thinking of openness between birth parents. And with foster care, we also are thinking in terms of openness with birth parents. But we also have extended family members who we may want to be maintaining, or it may be beneficial to the children. We also have siblings who may have been in a different either foster or adoptive home, so we're talking about openness there. And then, as you were just mentioning, we were talking about openness with previous foster families. So that's a lot of relationships to maintain. I'll start with you, Madeline, on this one. First of all, how important is it? And we know that it probably depends, so tell us what it depends on. How important is it to maintain these relationships? And then we'll move into talking about how to manage, you know, because there are a lot of relationships with which to manage, and some of which could be fairly problematic.
Well, openness is a continuum. Openness works when it is child-focused, child-centered, in the best interest of the child. And so, if the birth family are safe people and they also want what's best for the child, then we have a good base. And that may be birth parent. It may hopefully be siblings, because siblings are the longest relationship we'll have in life, I'm told. Grandparents, godparents. I mean, when somebody adopts a child from the system and there are many people involved in the child's life, it's asking the adoptive family to broaden their concept of a family and include other people in that child's life for the sake of the child, because that's their roots. So it may not be face-to-face. It may be Skyping. It may be letters. It may be any technology now. I mean, I have kids right now who are Facebooking a birth family. I have children who have, at age 10 and 11, have asked to open their adoption to meet their birth parents. And in one case, the girl's birth mother has seen the girl and then decided she doesn't want more contact, and the connection is with the grandmother. So there is a continuum, and it's not one size fits all. But it is, research shows that there is less fantasy of who they are. It gives them an opportunity to have somebody else who loves them. I'm not saying it's easy. It can be complicated. It's asking everybody to maybe set aside some of their differences and their idea of family in order for the child to be able to have a connection. And how that connection is has to be worked on over time, because it changes. It's complicated.
It is complicated, but it doesn't mean it's impossible. Kim, how are if a parent is getting ready to, an adoptive parent is considering adopting from foster care, is it possible for them to try to find connections, biological connections to the child? Obviously, the birth parents, usually that, especially the child's in the system, we know who the birth parents are. And one would assume that grandparents would be relatively easy to find. Does best practice indicate that adoptive families should try to find these people, grandparents, aunts, uncles? Hadn't thought about godparents, that's a good one, or neighbors who helped to raise the child. Or is that something that adoptive parents should seek out, especially when the child is young, before these contacts disappear?
Typically, that research is done by the agency when they're looking at prospective adoptive placements. So I would think that the agencies would have that information to hopefully connect the adoptive parents. And as Madeline said, safety is number one with these children, making sure that having that contact is safe. And then definitely, like we said before, you know, the more love the children get, the better it is. You know, how wonderful to have so many people who love them. I think the one thing that I would say to adoptive parents who are very scared of openness is they need to consider that at age 13, their kid's going to be on Facebook, and you never know when one night at a sleepover they say, hey, let's find my birth mom, and they type in a name, and there she is.
Mm-hmm.
So I really, you know, we live in a world of connectivity, and I think adoptive parents need to be as proactive as possible in preparing for that openness, being open if it's comfortable, and understanding their kids' desires to possibly have that connection at some point.
I can't stress that enough to the audience how much I agree. The reality is with the technology that's currently in place now, and certainly the technology that's going to be developed in the future that we can't even imagine, children, and I do mean children, are going to have access. I think that we as parents need to be proactive. I mean, I'm a big believer in trying to prevent, I don't think any kid needs to be on Facebook before the age of 13. That has nothing to do with adoption. But the reality is, I know 10-year-olds who currently have smartphones, which is another issue, another show, another concern, but nonetheless, there are children that have who have the access to the internet unsupervised now at a very young age. So parents being proactive ahead of time, sticking your head in the sand and saying, I don't want you to contact your birth family, is likely not going to work if your child wants to do it.
Right.
We do have resources on that. Quite a few. We've done a number of shows on this topic. In fact, we just had a fascinating discussion the last couple of days on the Creating a Family Facebook support group on exactly this, being friended by your child's birth parents. You know, one of the questions, Madeline, that I hear not infrequently from adoptive parents who have adopted from the system is that if the birth parent did things that were really bad to your child, abuse or extreme neglect, how do you reconcile, number one, your own feelings and of somebody's hurt your child? And how do you reconcile that and still try to give your kid a positive feeling towards who these people are if the people have really been pretty bad?
You know, there's a wonderful book that I'd also like to recommend. It's called Telling the Truth to Your Foster and Adopted Child. And one of the chapters in there talks about all the hard stuff, drugs, prostitution, rape, incest. And it does it by age, early preschool, early school age. It's wonderful, wonderful resource. It's right next to the Toolbox book for me because it is a wonderful resource. We have to, as parents and as therapists, speak for myself as a therapist, we have feelings about what's happened to these children. Some of them have been grossly abused and neglected. And they brought into the world this wonderful child. And so we have to deal with our own feelings. And then we have to be able to talk with our children about, I don't like what they did to you. I wish they hadn't done that. I wish you never had to have gone through that. But it's, you know, that's their behavior. I don't like their behavior. Many kids come into care very badly wounded, but they remember good stuff that went on. It may have been a fried egg sandwich. It may have been going to a party. They need to hold on to whatever is positive, and we need to talk about those birth families for who they were, that they didn't know how to parent, that they did many good things. They don't know how to parent. And that's why the judge and everybody decided that you needed another parent.
And if drugs are involved, I think you can, even at a young age, talk about drugs, that drugs make you not a good parent. Drugs make up your, mess up your mind and make you not able to make good choices. So we can actually add something into the, from an education standpoint at that stage.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I would agree. Here's a question from Kim. Our son-to-be's foster parents for 4 years do not plan on adopting him. He is now with us on the weekends, but he is very angry. How do we help him cope with the idea that his parents, in quotes, for 4 years, do not want to adopt him? Kim, I'm going to direct that one to you. Sorry.
It's a tough one. And a lot of times, you know, anger is rooted in fear. So he's fearful, he's angry. You know, and I'm going to say, Madeline, this is a good one for you because, you know, that's a tough spot.
Yeah, but Madeline.
Okay, I'll take some of that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know how old he is, but if he really, if he thought this was where he was going to be, he's entitled to his anger.
You know, he's been there 4 years, and regardless of his age, he probably thought it was going to be permanent.
But, you know, first of all, it's the loss of those people and the loss of his dream. And he doesn't understand, my guess is, that there are some people who only want to foster. And what does that mean? It's different than adopting. And I think we have to separate that out for children. In the old days, foster parents, where I grew up, couldn't adopt. But now they are... In millions of foster parents are adopting, thank God. But fostering is different than adopting. It is taking care of somebody for a short term. And so some children don't get that, and we need to help them to understand that. And then they need to understand the receiving family, the pre-adopt family, needs to be able to be comfortable with the sadness that's and the anger that's sitting there and maybe pushing them away. And they need to be able to listen to that sadness and listen to the anger, because underneath the anger was some expectation and a lot of fear.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really understanding where that anger comes from, keeping it safe anger. No, you cannot break windows. No, you cannot kick the dog. But I understand you're angry, so let's go shoot baskets, or let's go play baseball, or, you know, you can stomp, or you can tear up, it used to be tear up phone books, now we don't have phone books, you know, you can tear up paper. You know, they may need to be, the child may need to be directed to an acceptable angry outlet, but we have to understand that he's disappointed, that he had some expectation that this was going to go on, and maybe it wasn't clear.
This is Kim, and I agree, and I would also say that just because the family didn't want to adopt doesn't mean they don't want to be in his life.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I think it's important to keep that connection and keep them included in his life so that when he works through the anger and everything, they're still there. They're still part of his life.
I was speaking the same thing as you were speaking. It just seems to me where this would... Again, this doesn't always happen. There's not always good therapy available, and there's systems that are not willing to pay for the therapy, but this does seem like a good time, if that were an option, to have the adopted parents, the foster parents, and the child sit down with the counselor and have the foster parents explain why they're not adopting and that they can still love him. And again, some form of openness seems like it would be really helpful in this type of case.
This is Madeline.
You were getting ready to say something. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think there may be. I hope that this child has pictures of the fostering family and the relationships that are there that are important. The neighbors, the school. I mean, there's a lot of people that he's letting go of, and so there should be pictures. There should be stories. There should be a transition, and And again, I think it's an assault on kids' emotions when they, and they may have been surprised, he may have been totally shocked and surprised that he's moving. So I agree. Planning ahead for the move is really important, and sitting down with somebody who knows this work and who can really do it in a thoughtful manner specific to that child is really good work.
Something we often suggest, and it sounds like this might be a good idea here, is to give the child one of those portable cameras, or the disposable cameras is what I meant, and let him take pictures of what is important to him. And they might be different from what his foster parents would think would be important. It may be a picture of the school. It may be a picture of a place in the backyard that he has played with or played at for 4 years. Maybe friends or whatever. And I really like the idea, I think, that Madeline had said earlier about printing off the pictures, not just putting them on your computer. And the good thing about a disposable camera is I think you have to do that, although I'm not sure how that works anymore. It's been a long time since I bought a disposable camera, but you could even get a point and click fairly inexpensively now, and so that the child himself can be capturing his memories of the things that are important to him. One of the things that you had said before, I think it was Kim, and I love the idea about putting pictures of the child up around the house. It's one I hadn't thought about, and really I love that idea before the child comes. But also you said to have things from the child's previous life, in this case it would be in a foster home, that that you could bring with you. So what are some specific things, and kind of where's the line drawn as to what belongs to the kid and what belongs to the family, and what have both of you found to be important? I mean, we all know things like stuffed animals or something like that would be important for a child. But what are some other things that pre-adoptive parents can ask for from the foster family if they're adopting from a child that's been in another foster home? Kim, I'll start with you on that one.
Well, I think what Madeline said earlier about letting the child decorate their room, making it their own, that would be lovely. If they have bedding or things like that from their foster home, bring those along. A lot of times foster families will buy bikes and different toys and things, letting them take some of those things and with them when they go so that they feel like they have their stuff too, I think is really important. I know one of the writers in the book, an adoptive mom, the foster mom wrote her a letter, and she said every night, you know, he really likes this certain lavender lotion to be rubbed on his back. And what the adoptive mom saw was how important that was in calming him. It was just had this incredible calming effect that he still could do that sensory connection with the lotion and have that nice back rubbed on his back at night, and it just created a connection with them very quickly.
You know, that it strikes me as you're speaking, and I do remember that part of the book, reading that as well. And what I thought of at the time was how wonderful for that child that the foster mom and the adoptive mom were really communicating. And it seems to me that often in these situations, the adoptive parents, or perhaps I view it this way because often they're the ones who are asking for advice, at least to us, and so those people need to be reaching out to the foster family and asking specific questions. What does this child like to eat? What is her bedtime routine? Does she like to be hugged? What does she do when she is upset? These type of questions, you can't necessarily sit back and expect that the foster parent is going to think to provide you this information. What other questions, Madeline, would you recommend that potential adoptive parents ask of the foster parents, or for the foster parents listening, that they may want to share with the adoptive parents?
I think foster parents are the keepers of the child's history for however long the child is in that home. And lots of foster parents have pictures of the child's, in this case, this four years in a foster home. Can they get duplicates of that? Can they get stories about the child? Can they get the school pictures? Can they get the awards? Can they get the certificates? anything that you would want to be able to say, well, this is what we have. This is when you lived at so-and-so's house. These are some of the things you did, and these are some of the people you knew. So that there are, it's the memorabilia that I think when I talk to foster parents, they know tons about their kids, but the kids have moved, or they have something they found. And if they don't have the address, or if the worker, social worker has left, there's no way to get the stuff from the home to the adoptive home. And I hear that from kids a lot. I left something behind. I wish I had this. I don't have any pictures. You know, we shudder every September when school starts, now August, about the family tree and getting a picture of yourself as a baby.
Mm-hmm.
You know, foster families have an opportunity to really send that child with as much memorabilia, as much articles that were meaningful or they think later on will be meaningful for that child.
You know, as you speak, it occurs to me that perhaps one of the best things we can add to, if we compile a list of questions for adoptive parents to ask of foster parents prior to the placement, one of the best things is phone number, forwarding address. Also, you know, will you, if you're on Facebook or Twitter or one of the social networks, can you friend me or can we friend each other on here? You can keep up with the child. And just as importantly, we'll have an ability to reach you if we need to in the future to ask questions.
I think it's
you're
a great
right.
idea.
I do too, and you know, and we usually think that we will work through the state agency, the system. But you're right. So often the workers leave, they change, and files get harder to find. Institutional memory is not there. So yeah, that's a great idea.
This is Madeline. The other thing is, when I do life books, I copy them and I give them to the social worker for their records. Because through the years, I've had children moved with their life book, and they've been lost. And so there is a separate copy, now with copiers being so good, so that there is a copy that's kept by the agency. So that if the child, and I've heard of teenagers come back and say, I was mad one day and I tore up my life book, do you have a copy?
Yeah.
And that means a great deal.
Sure.
So, you know, it's thinking ahead. And thinking about what are the pictures that are meaningful to me? Do I like to look at my baby pictures? Do I like to hear stories about myself? Fostering families they're a treasure trove mm-hmm. of stories, and it means a great deal to the children.
Yeah, I can definitely see that. And making a copy of the life book is a great idea because you're right. Things happen. Life books get lost. One of the pages, one of the stories or essays, I should say, in the or article, whatever, in the foster parenting toolbox that I absolutely loved because it is so practical, and it's first night strategies. Now, it was meant for foster parents, but I think some of these same strategies are very, very helpful for adoptive families for their first night as well. I do think that it's helpful to give some thought, because adoptive parents are often thinking that this is going to be a glorious evening and everything is going to be, you know, they're so excited. This is the beginning of a life that they have anticipated and wanted. But a child may not be viewing it quite the same way. So I'd like to maybe talk about a few of the strategies. It's, for the audience, it's in the foster parenting toolbox. One of the strategies, and I'll start to give you guys a chance to think of some, is to allow the children to be in the clothes and the pajamas, toothbrush, all that from their first placement. Even if you think that the pajamas are kind of ratty, it's not a time necessarily to be producing a brand new pair, which I think is a great idea for parents to think about. Madeline, can you think of any other strategies for that first night or the first week, if you don't want to make it just the night, that we can do to try to help our kids and they come into our home?
I think we have to, as parents, we have to do a lot of listening, and we have to give them the structure, the basic structure. We don't go out at night. I mean, if these are walking, talking kids, you know, kind of the structure of the home, not in a, I don't want to say authoritarian manner, but this is how we live in our house. You know, we look out for each other so that there is a basic structure so that the child knows that. And yes, all the things that are important that can be put away, and that we ask kids, where would you like to put this? Where would you like to put that? Are there things still missing? Introducing yourselves, what would you like to call me? Do you want to call me, you know, Miss Jones? Do you want to call me, you know, Miss Mary? So that there is the opening and the expectation that there's going to be communication. The kids coming in, they're feeling scared, they're feeling powerless, they're uncertain, they don't know who the heck we are. So that the child begins to get a sense of basic structure and basic communication to build a relationship.
Mm-hmm. Kim, any specific ideas, either from the article First Night Strategies or any that you have seen throughout your years that work with children in the first days after they have moved to a new home?
I think one thing is just to take it slow. It doesn't all have to happen overnight. Attachment doesn't happen overnight. Relationships don't happen overnight. Take it slow with the children. Ask them what they would like. Ask them what their routines were, where they were before, if it was with their biological family or with a foster family. What are their routines? Try to incorporate some of those things into your family, into your routines. Those things are really important to give kids continuity in placements and families and homes, and to feel like they're welcome and wanted, and just to think about what your child is experiencing, what their experiences have been, and put yourself in their shoes. Like I said earlier, can you imagine coming home and thinking you're going home to your home that night with your family, and all of a sudden you're scooped up and you're going somewhere else, and they say, oh, you're going to have a great time, this is a great family. Wow. How would you feel as a child? That would be incredibly overwhelming and scary, and just put yourself in that child's shoes and just try to take everything down a notch, slow down, and try to make it as comfortable for them as possible.
I think that one of the things that you can do prior to this is going back to what we were talking about before. I think it was Kim's question, what she could do in advance. One of the things that may be helpful for adoptive families is to talk with the foster family and find out some of the child's favorite recipes and actually get the recipe. I know of a kid who adored macaroni and cheese, and his new adoptive mom made macaroni and cheese from her scratch and did it beautifully. And of course, you know the end of the story. He wanted Kraft macaroni, and he wanted the one that was the distinction. He didn't even want the one that took 5 minutes on the stove. He wanted the microwave one because that's what he had always had. But so information like that. But it could be reversed. It could be that he really loved a homemade version of it or whatever. And so recipes, asking for recipes. And one strategy on the first night is, assuming that it's early enough in the day that you have this option, would be to ask the child either what would they like to have for dinner, that we know, you know, that this is, everything's kind of topsy-turvy, so we're going to let you choose tonight. What would you like for dinner? And what would you like tomorrow morning for breakfast? I think people are often much more in their routines when it comes for in the morning and what they eat in the morning. Maybe it's just adults, but I think children as well. And if they're from a family that starts every day with Pop-Tarts, even if you aren't a Pop-Tart-eating type of family, and I say that because I'm not, it wouldn't hurt at that time to have Pop-Tarts to ease the transition and then gently say, you know, we'll have this on Saturday morning, but during school week days we're going to have something a little healthier. But move into that type of thing is an idea that would be helpful. We have unfortunately come to the end of our time, and I still had other things to ask. Rats! Thank you so much, Kim and Madeline, for being our guest today on Creating a Family to talk about transitioning from foster care to adoption. Kim, can you give, you've got a couple of websites that I'd like you to give out for people who would like more information either about you or about the magazine or about the Foster Parenting Toolbox.
You can find more information about the book at www.emkpress.com, or you can find us on Amazon. And the magazine Fostering Families Today can be found at www.fosteringfamiliestoday.com.
Excellent. Madeline, for people who want more information on you or for or CASE, which is the Center for Adoption Support and Education, how can they get that information?
The website is www.adoptionsupport, which is one word, adoptionsupport.org.
Thank you so much. To stay in touch with the latest developments in adoption or infertility, as well as receive the upcoming week's blog and show topic, you can sign up for our weekly newsletter at creatingafamily.org. The UN estimates that there are 143 million orphans in the world, including 107,000 currently available for adoption in the U.S. foster care system. These kids, as well as the millions of older children throughout the world, deserve a home. To get more information about the U.S. Kids Waiting for a Family, you can go to the Waiting Child page at creatingafamily.org, where we include links to various photo listings of some of these kids. Thanks for joining us today, and I will see you next week.
And now, an ad from Dad.
All right, save money on car insurance when you bundle home and auto with Progressive.
Can I take these off?
All right.
What is this? This looks good.
Wow.
That's well made.
Where did you get this? I'm talking to you with the hair. Yeah, where did you get this? It's good stuff. That's solid. That's not veneer. That's solid stuff.
Progressive can't save you from becoming your parents, but we can save you money when you bundle home and auto. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company affiliates and other insurers. Discounts not available in all states or situations.
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the...
Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.